RTHK Radio 3 with Take Care. Maurice Mitsilowski joins me on the line now from Melbourne in Australia. How are you?
I'm still good, Phil.
I'm still standing. I love my dates, Maurice, as you know. So today, in 1888, Thomas Edison, the man, filed a patent for the optical phonograph. I'm assuming that means projector.
Well, we would call it a projector today. Again, in his day, there was nothing like it. So it's one of these things we've talked about often that today seems so obvious, but in his day just absolutely didn't exist. They were just at this stage looking at photographs, and they were all the things we've seen in the movies, that big, huge box. They were put on glass slides. It was a very cumbersome thing. But what he had done previously, just a year or two before, was to invent the phonograph itself, which was the music, that thing that we wind up, that again we've seen in all the movies, that very, very early cylindrical thing. And what he imagined after a little while of playing and inventing with that was, why can't I put a picture onto it? But he had no real idea of how that might be. And what he saw was really a phonograph with pictures. It was just the extension of what he invented before with a little picture
which is ironic, because phono, I suppose, it means sound, and that came a good 30-odd years later, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But again, we've often talked about the evolution of things, and this was his evolution. Not quite sure how he would do it, but it seemed to make sense if he could record and play sound. He should be able to record and play movie, or a picture at least, and he began playing with it. And that's what we celebrate today, all the way back to 1888.
I suppose to bring your sort of area of expertise in this is to talk about the nature of why we do certain things, the culture of essentially loads of people sitting in a room together, chomping on their hot dogs and watching a film, and you're all about future. Are we still going to keep this idea? Although things are changing and television habits have changed, this old school thing, what about it?
I think we will, but it'll be a special occasion thing. We're still humans. We still are herd animals, meaning that we love to get together. There are times when it's really good to sit in the room with people we know or people we don't know. There are some films because they provide a better atmosphere, or there's something about seeing it in a larger environment that we want to do, that we'll continue to do. So I think there'll be movie theatres, but what I'm seeing here and overseas as well, we'd be interested to see if it's happening in Hong Kong, is that the movie theatre itself, that room that we sit in, is being changed. We've got one specific for kids that have, and I don't ever want to go in it, but they have play centres, they have slides in them and bean bags, and the kids play on that. We've got the larger gold class, of course, which I know is in Hong Kong, where you have a bit more of an intimate experience in a very large chair with food. So we're starting to play with that environment. We've also got a few cinemas here that are outdoor now, and they either are completely in a park where you sit there on a rug and eat a picnic, or we've got some that are in the building but on the roof, so to speak, and are outdoors. So those kinds of things are happening across the world.
I wonder where this sits in the spectrum of Edison's inventions. Would this be a fun one? Because he also invented a thing he called the fluoroscope, which became the X-ray machine.
Yeah, it did. I don't think he could have ever foreseen a time like this. I don't think that he foresaw the nature of us building a film industry, which has never happened before. Prior to that, the best that we had, and it was the best that we had, was live theatre. It was actors on a stage. I don't know. It would be interesting to know whether it occurred to him that we might one day be able to capture that and watch it not real, in other words, not on stage as it was happening, but at some delayed time in the future.
So staying with the early days here, I mean, musicals was a key thing, and sort of Cheap Charlie Theatre on the streets. Anybody could go to it. Brilliant entertainment for everybody. I wonder what the sort of the yearning, if you like, for people like him was to get it onto film. Was it just because, I think we can take a photo. Let's take loads of photos and see what happens.
He talks about the notion of being exactly that, that that's really where the evolution for this thing came from. It was being able to put a photo or something into it that could then be seen again and again. We've said already, but the important thing to remember, which is difficult living in our times, is that there really wasn't a way to capture materials prior to this. You could paint a picture, you could take a photo, but photos were really expensive, and they were only being done by those who had a lot of extra money around. So the notion of being able to capture a piece of theatre or a live show and to be able to show it to a whole lot of people across the world was still very, very new and unheard of for most people.
Was it a natural progression? And if you say yes, what's our next natural progression?
Well, the answer, of course, was yes. I mean, everything we do in history in humans is natural. It may not be something that we were born yearning, but it's something that we've desired and collectively decided it was a good thing. And we saw how quickly this industry grew that answers the question of yes. The next thing, as we've really begun to see the next thing, we now see people watching a piece of entertainment, whether it's a film or whatever, in a multitude of ways. They watch it on the big screen, they might watch it with a phone or an iPad or similar in their hand. We're beginning to see movies actually made for both screens at once. So you might watch the big screen, but you actually might engage with it. So you might look something up or deep dive or maybe see something else that the others aren't seeing. We're beginning to see those sorts of things. I saw a couple of months ago an interesting film, and I suppose we still do call it a film. I don't know if you remember back to the old kids' books where you could choose the ending and the plot. So you'd read a chapter and then you jump ahead to another chapter. It wasn't actually written to be in sequence. You could choose that. There are films being created which are quite similar that, of course, don't work on the big screen but work really well on the small screen, in other words, on your mobile or on your tablet, where you can, again, watch a beginning and then choose the next step and the next step and an ending, and it unfolds as you make choices. So we're starting to see those kinds of things happening.
Well, that completely changes the nature of movies in a way, Morris, because that chucks out of the window what they call the willing abandonment of disbelief. Just sit back and be spoon-fed. I wonder if we are now beginning to think we are in control of everything, and if that's a good idea.
Well, I think we are. The notion, and I say this often when I'm watching the news or current affairs, it is so common now to see somebody's video from their mobile phone. There was a plane issue last night in Australia where one of the airlines had to return back after doing quite a deep dive. And all we saw, I mean, all that we could have seen, of course, were people's mobile phone images. And we saw lots of those. We're seeing war-torn areas now from first-hand balconies. In other words, people standing on a balcony watching the shooting and watching the calamities happening. We've really become a first-person world. We're even beginning to shoot films now, traditional films, from first-person. In other words, the cameraman is actually wearing the camera and we're seeing it from her or his viewpoint. So we've significantly changed the way that we engage with the world in these spaces.
Funnily enough, in recent times, a lot of movies like that have been about turmoil and conflict and, you know, Jarhead and stuff like that.
Yeah, they have, and I don't enjoy them, not because of the content, but I find this notion of the film actually being jarring. In other words, it moves up and down as people walk up and down. This whole instability, I know there's a whole group of people that love it, and they should, but I find that really tiresome after a while.
What about, when you and I were younger, and I guess it was the 80s, and the very first video cameras and all that kind of stuff came out, was that the first step to a complete deviation from the movies, if you think about it, the equipment used and stuff?
Yeah, I think it was. Look, my favourite story quickly with that was my father, who's long gone. We were in Brazil. We were at one of the large events happening, one of the large street events. He had a camera that he'd bought in Hong Kong because he loved that kind of thing, which in those days was a huge thing you carried on your shoulder. It had a microphone the size of, I don't know what, almost a cricket bat. It was one of those really old-fashioned things. And he pulled it out of this briefcase, put it on his shoulder and began to film. And officials pushed him in to the main thing because they thought he was a ridgy-didge cameraman. They'd not seen something like that before. So he ended up filming this street event literally as if he was a cameraman. I mean, that always tickles my fancy. Now, he didn't look anything like it, didn't pretend to be. But again, that goes to your point that we are really now very much engrossed in this. It's from our viewpoint.
Right, still looking forward. Take it back to the good old sci-fi movies of the 50s and 60s. Their idea of what would be entertainment of this nature in the future tended to be about holography. Is that a dead door now?
No, it's absolutely where we're headed now. That what we're seeing, what we will see very soon, is the ability to have holographic images in our lounge room or in our cinemas. We'll actually see the actors moving around, and more importantly, we'll be able to be that actor as well. There's some interesting work being done in Hollywood and other places that allow us to project ourselves into that space and to project our environment. So it could be the streets that we're used to, the food that we eat. Those sorts of things we're able now to put into film. In fact, there are some films that are put out, and it's called product placement. In other words, there's discrete images like of food or cars that are in there, that are branding exercises. And you can now replace those for region quite easily. So we'll see a slightly different film to the one you'll see in Hong Kong to a different one they'll see in America.
I think a great example of what we're both talking about here was 1997 Robin Williams' film Flubber. It's a bit of fun. It's always fun to watch that one. But he has a robot, a hovering robot called Weibo. And she starts to love the professor, and she turns herself into a hologram. And that's all she wants. She wants to be of human form, and it's the hologram. So that was the late 90s. Where were they then with that technology?
It was really embryonic. It was a fanciful thing. I mean, to me, it was the holodeck that I wanted and still want. But I've actually seen a holodeck. We've spoken about it before. It's used in a number of universities. It's not used for entertainment purposes, but for instruction purposes. But it is so close to what the holodeck used to want to be that you walk into this. And I said to you many times, I've actually been to Mars in this thing. I've been inside the human brain. It's a totally different experience. It is immersive to the nth degree. I actually think we'll see technology like that.
I've just had a thought. So instead of looking at holograms from the outside, I suppose we're now looking at from the inside with virtual reality headsets.
Yeah, and the virtual reality headsets to me were a bit of a gimmick. You know, we still haven't seen a great purpose for it. 3D television has come and gone. We didn't see a great purpose for that. So I'm not seeing it necessarily in the way that we currently have it. But these deep immersive experiences are definitely somewhere on the horizon. Somebody has to figure out how to make it commercially viable and useful. But they will.
Is this another one of those things, staying with holograms and stuff, is this another one of those things that really wasn't even conceived or invented for entertainment use? I think it was 70s. It wasn't that long ago in the big picture. Would it have been used for some military or whatever use?
No, my understanding was holograms were always seen as being these things that were a bit fanciful. They were definitely meant to be this movie-type experience. I've actually seen holograms used at airports, strangely enough.
Oh, yeah.
Heathrow used to have a hologram, I mean, she happened to be a woman, because that's what they projected, that told people where to go in the queue. So we've seen them around a little bit. But no, their purpose, I think, was always to be this fanciful stand-in.
Very often, Morris, these famous inventors, they had forward developed their stuff by at least 100 years, but obviously they weren't allowed to do it. We mentioned this last week with Da Vinci. Do you think Edison perhaps was the same? Do you think he saw, you know, the kind of things we're talking about as an offshoot of this first thing, this phonographic lens thing?
Yeah, I do. Look, Edison was slightly different. I mean, Da Vinci also had the same kind of quirk, but he was working in an era when technologies, again, were just starting to be innovated. He was working in a space not dissimilar to today, where the engines were just starting to come about. So his whole world was about invention and the possibilities around that. We can't really speak too highly of that time, because it really is a very akin to today without our internet, but the equivalent of machinery. So he was seeing possibility, and what he was able to do, I mean, there's lots of discussion about whether he did it or whether he copied it or all sorts of things, but putting that to an aside, what he was able to do was live in a time where it might be possible to build some of these things. And he didn't just talk about this projector, he actually built a prototype. I mean, it was crude and not useful, but it was a prototype nevertheless.
You recently did some work in Aussie on the future of beauty, and I'm assuming something that we're talking about plays into that. Tell me more.
Yeah, it does. So I've just put together a whole series, and there's actually an article coming out in about a month's time, about my belief of beauty being changed across the world. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. It's the notion that we now drink from the same cooler, that most of our impressions of what looks good and what doesn't is taken from some kind of a Western, mostly American-type persona that we see in movies. The thing I lament, of course, is in Korea, the number one thing that's being done for cosmetic surgery is people are changing their eyes to a more westernized eye. And that's something like about 80% of all procedures now being done. Again, that comes from this centralization of beauty. But strangely...
We're talking about the eyelid procedures.
Yeah, we are.
I too don't understand, but it's massively popular, not just in Korea, China too, all over.
Yeah, so again, that comes from this centralized vision of beauty, I think. You know, this notion of what we've seen on our films and in our books and in our magazines. We're kind of saying that this is normal now, this is average, and if I want to be this kind of person, I need to begin to change my face or my image. Now, I've actually taken it a step further. I've begun to think about the notion that I think beauty is actually returning back to being hyper-personalized. After we get over this big hurdle of seeing this typical view. I think what we're seeing now with our selfies is that in fact we come in all shapes and sizes, all flavors and different varieties. And I'm beginning to see the notion that we are in fact, hopefully, accepting that as being more normal. In other words, we can be ourselves. The way we look is fine. We don't necessarily need to change things. So that was really where that conversation, that keynote and that article took itself.
When you listen to you talking about this, the assumption is you're talking about women, but I'm sure you're not.
No, I'm not. I'm absolutely not. I'm talking about men, women, and predominantly the thing that I lament the most is it's mostly for children too. That one of the things I noticed, and we all know this now, but I noticed about a decade or so ago, was that children were becoming really wrapped up in self-image. And yes, they did that, but they tended not to do that at the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old. They tend to do that more when they hit their teens. And that really distressed me, that again, they were seeing common images across all of media, that they were constantly being fed, and they were being told that if you want to be normal, this is how you have to look. A lot of issues we've had have been based on that. I'm hoping, and maybe it's more hope than proof, but I do see some proof of it, that is slowly beginning to change.
Do you think this obsessive level of self-awareness coincidentally was born when the social media phenomenon came up?
It wasn't born, but it certainly flamed it. We have always been We've always been self-obsessed. I mean, we are as humans. We shouldn't read into that a too negative thing. In order to sustain ourselves and to live the way we do, we have to have some sense of self-worth and self-belief. There's no issue around that. That's a natural and quite comfortable thing for us to do. But yes, as we began to talk in social media, as we began to compare ourselves with people that were outside of our normal. So our normal was only 25 kilometres from our feet. People tended to be the same, think the same, look the same. Predominantly because we couldn't see anybody else really. Now we see lots of people. That's what social media did. It opened us up to an entire world and gave us their conversation and their images. That immediately, strangely enough, changed the view of who we are and what we are on this planet. And I'm hoping it's rebounding now slowly.
As always, Maurice, food for thought. Thank you very much. That's Maurice.